First of all, Deuteronomy chapter 16, verses 18 through 22, and then Deuteronomy 17, verses 14 through 20. So first, Deuteronomy 16, 18. You shall appoint for yourselves judges and officers in all your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, according to your tribes, and they shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not distort justice, you shall not be partial, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not plant for yourself an Asherah of any kind of tree beside the altar of the Lord your God, which you shall make for yourself. Neither shall you set up for yourself a sacred pillar, which the Lord your God hates. 17:14. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your brother. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God, by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. I read these two passages to you for a variety of reasons. One, because in our study of history, we're talking about heads of state and rulers and politicians and people in places of political power. And also because this is election season now through November. And it's important always to keep in our mind the standard that God has for a person who's going to be placed in a position of political power. And the way you determine who you're going to vote for is you compare the candidates to the standard of God's Word. And the one that comes the closest to that standard you vote for. Winnability, party, all irrelevant. That the standard is how we judge the candidates. And people have forgotten what a person in political power is supposed to do. So let me just very quickly rehearse for you some of the main points of these two passages in about 5 or 10 minutes. But before I do, I want you to notice something interesting about these passages. Now here you have in Deuteronomy 16, 18 through 22, God's laws governing judges and civil magistrates. And then in chapter 17, verses 14 through 20, you have God's laws versus regarding the head of state. But now I want you to notice what's in between. Notice what starts on in Deuteronomy 16, verse 1. Observe the month of Abib and celebrate the Passover of the Lord your God. For the month of Abib, the Lord your God brought you out of Egypt by night. And then it proceeds to give ceremonial laws regarding religious festivities in Israel. And then after going through all those various religious feasts, in verses 18 and following, he talks about judges. Then in chapter 17, says, you shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep which has blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord your God, etc. And then it proceeds to give laws regarding sacrifices and Levites. And then in verse 14, it goes back to the subject of political powers. Now, why does it do that? Don't you think it'd be a lot more orderly if you had a section of Deuteronomy that referred to politics and a section of Deuteronomy that referred to ceremonial rituals so you could keep the thing clear? Why did you do it like this? Why did you sort of mix up the whole thing? You talk about ceremonies one place, you talk about political laws the next place. Is it because in Old Testament Israel there was no separation of church and state? No. That's the common myth. The common myth is that one of the basic characteristics of a theocracy is that there's no separation between church and state. It is a myth for which there's absolutely no basis in the Word of God. The primary characteristic of a theocracy, it's governed by God's law, administered through elected representatives. That's what a theocracy is. It is a nation whose constitution is based upon biblical law, and that constitutional law, based on biblical law, is administered and defended by people elected by the people, by representatives elected by the people to administer that law. Old Testament Israel had its separation of church and state. New Testament church had its separation of church and state. And the fact that all these laws are all mixed up does not mean that in the Old Testament Hebrew Republic there was not the separation of church and state. There were things Moses could do that could not do that only Aaron, the priest, could do, etc. What is the point? The point is that though there is a clear institutional, functional, jurisdictional separation between the institutional church and the state, there is absolutely no separation of either church or state from the law of God. That the law of God is comprehensive. It's life-wide. It leaves out nothing. And that the church is no more accountable to obey the law of God as is the state. They are both equally accountable to obey God's law because God's law is all-embracing, life-wide, comprehensive. Now notice what God's law says judges and people in political power are to do. It makes it very clear in verse 18, they are to judge the people with righteous judgment. Verse 19, they're not to distort justice. Verse 20, justice and only justice you shall pursue. So it just hammer blow after hammer blow. Judges, do righteous justice. Don't pervert justice. Justice and only justice shall you pursue. So, you get the point? The judges are supposed to be concerned with justice and nothing else. They're not supposed to be with family counseling. They're not supposed to be concerned with reconciliation. They're not supposed to be concerned with rehabilitation of the criminal. They're not supposed to be concerned with health, education, and welfare. They're only supposed to be concerned with administering justice. And not justice as they interpret it, but righteous justice. What's the definition of righteousness? It is conformity to biblical law. So righteous judgment is judgment that is punishing wrongdoers, protecting rightdoers in terms of biblical law. That's the only mandate any judge, whether he's state, municipal, federal, whatever he be, that's the only mandate God has ever given judges. And if any judge, now listen, if any judge is not a champion of biblical law, he always turns out to be a hatchet man for the humanistic status quo. Always happens. Notice on verse 21 and 22, directed to judges and people in political power, it says, don't plant for yourself an Asherah. Verse 22, neither shall you set up for yourself a sacred pillar. In other words, make no room for religious plurality. Don't you worship any other god. Don't you be committed to any other religion or ethical system. And don't let any other religion or ethical system be allowed to flourish in that nation over which you have the charge. So that in a Christian nation, idolatry and the public worship of idols is not only prohibited, but a capital crime, according to the book of Deuteronomy. Now notice in Deuteronomy 17, verse 14, it's addressed to the king. So you can have a king, you can have a president. Anybody that is philosophically against a king as the head of state has to set himself against Deuteronomy 17. That's why I say Cromwell probably should have taken the title and he'd have solved a lot of problems. Maybe. But notice what it says about the head of state, whether he be king or president or Lord Protector. He says in verse 15, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses, one of your brothers. It's not literally countrymen, it's brothers in Hebrew. Somebody who is your covenantal brother. Somebody who shares the covenant with you, the bond of the covenant, who shares the same worldview, perspective, commitment, ethics, religion that you do. Now remember, he's addressing a Christian people. And therefore it is the responsibility of a Christian people only to elect Christians to places of political power. I believe you're sinning whenever you vote for somebody who's not an evangelical Bible-believing Christian. Because he's not your brother. That the person that you vote for, the person that you say you choose for yourself, has to be a brother. A covenantal brother who shares the commitment to God that presumably you share. It says concerning this man, verse 16, he shall not be a foreigner. Now that means he can't be somebody who is a part of another covenant. Moreover, verse 16, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Here's a man that cannot be a warmonger. He cannot be somebody committed to war, to militarism, committing young Americans to fight in wars that do not involve the protection of the welfare, security, religion, and property of Americans. Moreover, verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. That means two things. One, he can't be a man committed to, that is, an immoral man. But the reason you'd marry a bunch of wives back in those days is to make political alliances. And so he's not a man who trusts on political alliances. In fact, he understands that it is forbidden him to make political alliances with other nations that do not share his religious and that nation's religious perspective. Nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. That is, he cannot be given to wealth and power. His administration cannot be given to wealth and power. Therefore, he's not going to tax you much. Now, it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, verse 18, he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests. And it shall be with him, his constant companion. And he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes. That the head of state is to be a man who loves biblical law. It's his constant companion. He's always thinking about it. He has on his staff in the White House a Levitical priest. That is somebody who has an encyclopedic understanding of the Word of God that he can go to and get advice from and check what the Bible says so he doesn't have to depend upon himself. He loves God's law because he knows that unless he administers without God's law, his definition of justice becomes a purely arbitrary and cruel one. So the only presidents you want are presidents who are theonomous. President of the United States who's not a theonomist is your enemy. A theonomist is somebody who loves God's law as it's found in the Bible and who makes God's law as it's found in the Bible, particularly those civil laws in the Bible which he himself is commissioned to enforce and obey. That he makes God's law his delight and his one goal in office is to obey the law of God in his own life, to make sure his administration obeys the law of God, and then to enforce the law of God as it applies to civil affairs nationally. Verse 20, that his heart may not be lifted above his countrymen, his brothers, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. So that's the kind of leaders we pray for. No other kind of leaders will do you any good. Any other kind of leader is a sign of God's curse and God's judgment upon a culture. Let's go back now to see a man who came close to meeting that standard, William of Orange. Last week, when we finished, we had kicked out James II. We saw that James Stuart II had attempted to imposed Roman Catholicism back on the Protestant nation of England, and as a result, he, for all practical purposes, got himself fired. And another man and woman were brought to the throne, William of Orange and his wife Mary, in what has been called the Revolution, the Glorious Revolution of 1688. That's something that every freedom-loving Protestant in the United States should know something about. Just like we should know something about the Protectorate, Cromwell, and what he sought to establish. Just like we should know something about the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 and those terrible days of tyranny under Charles II and James II. We must also understand the glorious revolution of 1688 in Great Britain, because that simply put into place many of those very principles and ideas and goals for which Cromwell fought and for which Cromwell lived. The Glorious Revolution in 1688 in England was unique among modern revolutions or uprisings in that it had no obvious social or economic motivation. You do a study of revolutions, you can find that 9 times out of 10, it's because somebody's being mistreated. Somebody socially, their rights are being violated, or economically, there's all kinds of poor people with a few rich people, and the poor people get jealous of the rich people. That you can always find some social or economic cause for a revolution, but you cannot find any social or economic cause for the revolution in England in 1688. It came suddenly and unexpectedly upon a nation which was enjoying unprecedented prosperity and social peace. And yet a massive revolution took place. Now, if there's no social or economic cause for the glorious revolution of 1688, what was the cause of this revolution? It was obviously a religious cause. The answer to the question, what caused the revolution, is not hard to find. Most Englishmen believed and were fully convinced that King James II was determined to impose upon England a Roman Catholic tyranny similar to that of his hero, King Louis XIV of France, the Sun King. The great Roman Catholic determined to conquer Europe for the Pope. Most people believed that James II was trying to take England back under the power of the Pope and destroy the Protestantism of that land that had been nourished and developed and was maturing for almost two centuries. You see, this nation of England had been transformed in both its outlook, its mentality, and its spirit by the great Puritan Reformation and the civil wars under Cromwell that changed so much of England's life. And with this Puritan influence so permeating the land, Englishmen were not prepared, even the weakest of them, to acquiesce, to surrender to any such Romanizing policy of their kings, even if the king had a standing army to put his policies into effect. They were not ready to surrender their Protestantism. If you remember from last week, we gave two reasons, and I want to give a third tonight, evidences as to that prove that most Englishmen were against James Stuart II by this time. Now, he came to the throne, he'd only been reigning just a handful of years, and now most Englishmen are fed up with him. Right from the start, they didn't want him. What happened right at the beginning of James Stuart's reign, after Charles II died and James, the Roman Catholic, came to the throne in blatant breach of the Constitution because Roman Catholics were not allowed to be monarchs in England? What happened? Charles II's favorite illegitimate son, Jim Walters, the Duke of Monmouth, made an alliance with the godly Scottish Presbyterian, the Earl of Argyll, to stage an invasion and a revolution, and that was put down, and yet thousands of Englishmen, peasants, joined up with the Protestant Monmouth and the Presbyterian Argyll against the king, but the king brutally put them down, thousands of them. Moreover, you remember last week we talked about King James trying to control local politics, and so he sent his lieutenants around asking everybody three questions to try to force people who were loyal to the crown to be elected to office. And when they finally asked all those questions, they found out that most of the people were not in accord with King James's program of tyranny. Well, now I want to give you a third reason why. It's obvious that most Englishmen wanted to get rid of Roman Catholic James II. Now, we've told you that William of Orange, this Dutch Presbyterian, and his English wife Mary are invited to come over and to rescue them. William and Mary, whom we're going to talk about this evening, bring their army over to, if necessary, fight King James and overturn the throne. But now listen. King James had a navy that had never been beaten in any naval battle. He had an army that was twice the size of William's army. And yet he didn't put up a fight. He immediately surrendered. And for all practical purposes, the revolution was bloodless. And because most of the people would not have supported the king in this war. Well, now let's talk about William and Mary. William of Orange, a Dutch prince, sailed from the Netherlands for England in November 1688 with a flotilla of 600 ships carrying 15,000 troops. His ships were covered with banners, and the banners read, Pro Religione Protestante, Pro Libero Parlamento, for the freedom of the Protestant religion, for the freedom of Parliament. This guy was a Calvinist. But although he was prepared to fight, no armed conflict was needed. Cowardly James, true to his Stuart name, fled England for France and took up with King Louis XIV. Why did this Dutch prince invade England? Because he had more than ample proof that King James was going to join with Louis XIV and overrun all of Europe, including England and Holland, and all of the Protestant North with their Roman Catholic armies in an attempt to bring Europe back into the Roman Catholic fold. And he wasn't about to allow that to happen. Well, when William landed on the English shores, England was technically without a king. James had fled. No parliament was in existence. So William immediately summoned an unofficial gathering of nobles and any knight or citizen or burgess or gentry that served in any of the parliaments under James II. Gathered them together with various political representatives from the city of London, to ask their advice on what do we do now. And this convention parliament, not really a parliament, met, in fact, it wasn't that legal. Nobody elected these guys to office. They were appointed by William of Orange. Ever heard anybody criticize William for doing that? No. Have you ever heard anybody criticize Cromwell for doing it? Yes. I wonder why there is such inconsistency. But anyway. So, on the advice of this parliament, they declared that King James had broken his covenant with the English people. You remember, we're now shades of John Knox. Remember last week we saw that was his original view of government, that government is covenantal. It's based on covenants. And when a king breaks the covenant, the people are no more accountable to him and no more obligated to obey him. And so they declare that because King James had broken the original covenant between the king and the people, he had abdicated and the throne of England was vacant. Moreover, this parliament declared that it is inconsistent, in their words, with the safety and welfare of this Protestant kingdom to be governed by a popish prince, unquote. And so they decided to offer the crown to William of Orange and his wife, Mary. But before they offered them the crowns of England, the Declaration of Rights, remember that, the Declaration of Rights was drawn up, to which William and Mary had to agree if they were to be given the crown. This Declaration of Rights did two things. It listed all of the crimes of James II and the rest of the Stuarts against the English people. And it spelled out the basic rights of all Englishmen. 1689. I wonder if they used that for a model for something that was written in 1776 called the Declaration of Independence, which first of all spelled out the crimes of the government of England against the states, and then spelled out the rights of Americans. Same type of document. So, February 1689, William and Mary signed this document in the banqueting hall of Whitehall Palace. Now, it's significant where they signed the Declaration of Rights, because the Whitehall Palace, as you saw in the movie Cromwell, was the room from which Charles I walked to his execution for tyranny just 40 years early, because he wouldn't give rights to Englishmen. And now you have the monarchs of England signing a Declaration of Rights. When they did that, they were declared to be the rightful rulers of realm, and the bloodless revolution was completed. But James II decided to make one last stand, feeble though it was. So James II, escorted by a French fleet, Roman Catholic fleet from Louis XIV, landed. Now, if you were James II, and you had a Catholic fleet, and you wanted to establish a base of operations whereby you would get your throne in England back, where would you land? Ireland. So he lands in Catholic Ireland. Most of Ireland stood with James II, except for the northern part. And what was in the northern part? The Scotch-Irish Presbyterians, of which most people in the Appalachian Mountains in the south are descendants. And none of the Scotch-Irish stood with James II, but all the other Irishmen, Roman Catholic and pagans that they were, stood with him. So William of Orange took his army into Ireland. His army was called the Orange Men. Orange was the color of the Protestants. And he decisively whipped James II at the Battle of Boyne, July the 1st, 1689. So the revolution was not as bloodless as we have been told. By the way, I learned a lot about orange being the color of Protestantism, green being the color of Roman Catholicism. 22 years ago, when Becky was pregnant with Anne, she and I were in Scotland. I went to a soccer game. I only had one corduroy coat with me, green. I did not take notice that I was in the bleachers where everybody had orange coats on. I hadn't taken notice that it was everybody on the other side that had green coats on. But it was very quickly pointed out to me that I was sitting in the wrong bleachers. Going all the way back to William of Orange and his Orange Men. Now, let me tell you something about William. And most of this comes from a great little short book on William and Mary and the Glorious Revolution by Marjorie Bowens. She wasn't a great lover of Calvinism, but she did have a great appreciation of William of Orange. William of Orange was also called King William III of England. Who was the first William? William the Conqueror, the French Norman, who whipped the Anglo-Saxons, the Battle of what? Hastings, in what year? All right, very good. And who was the second William? William Rufus, his son. William of Orange, King William III of England, was a prince, a courageous war hero, the deliverer of Protestants in England and Holland, a Calvinist, a Presbyterian, a Dutchman, an asthmatic crippled with tuberculosis. He descended from the great William the Silent, who was the heir of the generations of the Counts of Nassau, one of whom was the Emperor of the Western Empire. Charles' mother was, of all things, the oldest daughter of Charles I, whom Cromwell executed. And William's mother was called Mary Stuart. He was married to James II's daughter, whom he just kicked out of England, whose name was Mary Stuart. And so he was heir to the English crown through his mother. Orange. Where did that word come from? Orange was a small, independent Dutch state that did not recognize the sovereignty of any other nation over it. It considered itself a free, Calvinistic Dutch republic. William of Orange held several notable titles, owned vast estates, and much personal wealth. But his most valuable possession was the extraordinary history of the title that he held, the Prince of Orange. That office was held by some of the most remarkable men ever to live in the continent of Europe. And his rise to power against great odds is an exciting one. Let me tell you something about his character. First of all, about his golden life. His entire life was dramatic. From his premature birth to his sudden death resulting from a fall from a horse. His whole life was extraordinary, romantic, tragic, dramatic, and full of action. As Marjorie Bowen said, about his character was an air of greatness not to be discerned in any other public man of his day. This is to be ascribed to the fact that he and he alone did not stand for merely personal ambition or personal glory, but for an absolute ideal for which he was prepared to make endless sacrifices, that is, the liberty of Protestantism from all tyranny. This steady adherence to an ideal gives a nobility to his entire career. Magnanimous is the epithet best suited to a prince of whom nothing mean or petty is known. Briefly, the aim of the Bourbons, Louis XIV of France, was to overrun Europe, crushing out Protestantism in his stride. And the aim of William of Orange was to stop Louis XIV. The one person standing in the way of the mighty France from overthrowing Protestantism in Europe is a small, asthmatic, crippled man who is the head of a small, little state. William of Orange. Showing us that once again, God has chosen the weak and the base to confound the high and the mighty, that he might receive all praise. William of Orange was a courageous man. The task that he had to stop France and Louis XIV in 1672 was, for all practical purposes, or as it appeared to everybody, hopeless. When William came to power at the age of 21, he found himself the general of a small army that was miserably equipped, disorganized, already falling back on the frontiers that were falling at the hands of the enemy. He was the head of state of a small little state that had been confused by a French invasion, distracted by a revolution. He was the cousin of Louis XIV through his mother and the grandson of Charles II through his mother. Of Charles I, and Charles II was his uncle. He was the chief magistrate of this Dutch Republic. And his task of stopping France from overwhelming Holland and Protestantism in the eyes of his contemporaries was ludicrously hopeless. The Dutch had been fighting for their lives and for their freedom for decades against first the Spanish Roman Catholics, then the French Roman Catholics. And they were worn out. They had very little of any spirit of resistance left within them. And many of them were for accepting any humiliating terms forced upon them simply to quit fighting. King Louis of France was willing to be generous to William of Orange. And Charles II was good-naturedly disposed toward his sister's son. So Louis and Charles suggested that William, who was a sharp man, they didn't want to waste this guy's talents, that William should surrender the few Dutch towns that were left to him that hadn't been overthrown by the French, and that when he surrendered his armies in these towns, then France would dismember the Netherlands, these united Dutch Calvinistic provinces, and when France dismembered them, Louis would give him one. He'd give him his own little princedom, his own little duchy that he could have control over, but he ultimately would be accountable to the sovereignty of Louis XIV. Also, Louis and Charles thought it would be sweet if they also offered William the hand of one of Louis's illegitimate daughters. Both kings thought this would be a handsome provision for a man of their own class who unfortunately had been sidetracked by republicanism and puritanism. But, as attractive as that may have been, William had the rare virtue of patriotism. He loved his country. And he was also deeply attached to the hereditary faith of his country, for which so much blood was shed, that is Calvinism and Presbyterianism. He also had cherished a keen sense of personal honor, sentiments that were scarcely to be understood by the Stuarts and the Bourbons. Added to these qualities were a tenacity of purpose, an indomitable fortitude, and a stern resolution that have seldom been equaled, and that from his first appearance on the European scene profoundly impressed the world. To these uncommon, extraordinary moral and intellectual abilities was joined in William a courage that nothing on earth could shake. So William didn't take the bait that was offered of his own little duchy and of an illegitimate daughter of the Sun King. He was not about to surrender to the sovereignty of the United Provinces, these Calvinistic republics of Holland, to the sovereignty of France and England. This took great courage for him, because by this time there wasn't much left to these Dutch provinces due to the ravages of war. But he told Louis XIV and Charles II that he would never betray the trust that his people had given him, and he would never sell the liberties of his country for which his ancestors had shared their blood. Well, the compromising and unprincipled Duke of Buckingham, one of the chief advisors of Charles II, urged him to accept the offer. He said, "William," now this is, I'm just putting words in his mouth here, but he said something to this effect, "William, for all practical purposes, your country does no longer exist." And then he did say to William, "Don't you see that your country's lost?" To which Prince William said, "It is indeed in great danger, but there is a sure way never to see my country lost, and that is to die in the last ditch." Now, what do you mean by that? Well, he had reference to the cutting of the dikes. The desperate expedient, the desperate measure whereby the higher levels of Holland would be saved by breaking the dikes and flooding everything in Holland below sea level, protecting what was remaining of Holland from the enemy by drowning the rest of the country. William meant that he would cut one ditch, one dike after another, and perish in the last one if he had to. And therefore, in perishing in the last ditch, he would not see his country lost. He'd be dead. Now you know where the phrase that you've used so many times come from, in making a last ditch effort to do this or that. It came from the mouth of William of Orange. What does a little crippled man do standing against the tide of the French Catholic army? He checked the French offensive. And in just two campaigns, this 21-year-old man drove the enemy out of his country, consolidated his position, and became one of the most important people in European politics. And he was pure. Even when he was a bachelor, he was pure. Bachelor kings and princes didn't have to be pure in those days. I mean, look at the Stuarts. Licentiousness and debauchery dominated the courts of the Stuarts and of the kings of France. What was it that dominated the courts of William, even when he was a bachelor? Dignity, purity, modesty. What was his lifestyle like? William had remarkable self-control, and he never lost his head in a crisis. But he was a sinful human being. His feelings were passionate, his senses acute, and he often expressed himself warmly and even violently. Nor was he always in the midst of a battle or seated before a pile of state papers. He hunted, played cards and billiards, had an educated interest in art, horticulture, and architecture, had a genius for friendship, was careful by principle and extravagant on occasion, could joke, enjoy a camp story, have 25 violins divert and comfort him whenever he was depressed, and was capable of the extremes of emotion, from agitation to hope to despair to joy. And his strong affections and emotions would often throw him into illness and into tears. From 1678 to 1688, France was the dominant power in Europe in politics, commerce, wealth, the arts, fashion. James II, the King of England, was on, as we said, the French Louis XIV's payroll. He was a spy being paid by the French king to spy on the English people. And the widespread corruption in England had reduced England to a second-rate power in European politics. In the meanwhile, William of Orange had become the unofficial leader of the English opposition to James the Second, but discreetly, because he was also very careful to stay on good terms with Charles and James. William was very popular with two groups in England. Who do you think they were? First of all, they were the Puritan nonconformists. You remember what a nonconformist is? When the Stuarts required total conformity to Anglicanism and said you had to swear allegiance to Anglican doctrine and practice and liturgy or you'd be ejected from your pulpits, these many, many faithful Presbyterian preachers and others, 2,000 of them, were ejected from their pulpits. They refused to conform to the Anglican model. They were Puritans. They were Calvinists. 90% of them Presbyterian. These people liked and loved William. They saw him as a possible Joshua who would deliver them from the threats of Anglicanism and Roman Catholicism because William himself was a Dutch Puritan. Many of these Puritans, by the way, had met William when they were exiled from England in Holland. There was a second group in England with whom William was very popular, and that was the middle class, the merchants, the businessmen, who saw William as a representative of law and order and common sense. But the person that I love in the whole story is Mary, his wife. Mary Stuart, namesake, was Bloody Mary. One of the most evil, bloodthirsty monarchs ever to reign in England. Mary Stuart II was the godliest queen England has ever had and was a staunch Calvinist. She was Queen Mary II, the Protestant daughter of the Roman Catholic King James II. By his marriage to Anne Hyde, she was the figurehead of Protestantism, of the English Protestants, in 1688. She was a sincere, staunch Calvinist. During the 10 years of marriage to William in Holland, 1678 to 1688, they'd been married 10 years before they came back to England. During the 10 years of marriage to William in Holland, Mary enjoyed peace and great happiness with him, and she was ecstatically in love with her husband. Mary was always in poor health, but she was good-natured, good-humored, hard-working, easygoing, enjoying the comfort and the peace of her husband's beautiful, stately mansions and gardens. Mary loved her flowers, her music, her needlework, and her friends. All Mary possessed of passion, tenderness, loyalty, and enthusiasm was lavished on the man whom she had so unwillingly married as a young teenager in an arranged marriage, her husband. But now all her life and passion was wrapped up in him. She accepted him and all he stood for with unquestioning fervor. To her, William was the Protestant hero. And she believed in him and admired him with a touching singleness of mind. Her one great grief was that she was childless. She's been described by those who knew her as, quote, this is what she looked like now, tall, majestic, inclined even at 21 to stoutness. That's a nice way of saying it. Inclined even at 21 to stoutness, with a gentle, melancholy expression in her fine, dark, weak eyes. Mary was not very intelligent. She was almost entirely uneducated. But she was, in her simplicity, courage, fidelity, godliness, an admirable woman. William, once he came to England, was slandered and hated by some people, praised by other people, misunderstood by many people, tolerated by others. His entire administration of King of England was a turmoil of stress, of business, politics, war. He could never find rest or pleasure, but he was constant to his own goals and ideals, the liberation of Europe from the tyranny of Rome. And it was constancy to those ideals in face of turmoil that he passed the 13 years of his reign. His health failed rapidly from the day he came to England. And he was troubled to his heart by what seemed to him petty party squabbles and such divisiveness and schism and fragmentation of the Puritan Republic causes. He found the whole thing maddening difficult to find anyone trustworthy enough to serve him. Here's what he said one time. There are honest men in England, but they are not among any of my friends. He was surrounded in his court by people who were seeking place and prestige, ambitious men, traitors, men with a foot in each camp, people waiting for him to die, indifferent opportunists. But William's one loyal minister was Queen Mary II. Her letters to him when she was governing, during his absences, when he had to be out of the country, reveal a state of affairs in England so desperate as to be almost incredible. In fact, during the reign of William, which appears in retrospect so orderly and so established and so sudden and so easy, it was often touch and go that another revolution did not bring James back or establish a republic. Any time it appears, things were so desperate that there was always the potential for another revolution or the overthrowing of the Calvinistic king. Historians have frequently blamed William for not becoming a true-born Englishman and for always keeping a passionate affection for his own Holland. The fact that he would not identify himself in citizenship with his mother's people, the English, was always resented by the English. But at that point in time, the Netherlands were much ahead of England in European commerce and in inventions and industry. And England benefited from Dutch tastes, crafts, and inventions because William encouraged these things to be introduced into England. Although English people did not like William by and large, and although William was not particularly fond of English people, nevertheless, he never put his duties to the English and his interest for the English and English Puritanism, he never put them second to his concerns for his own country. They were first in his life. When William and Mary arrived in England, it was assumed that the throne was vacant and that Mary, the daughter of James II, should be Queen Regent and her husband William, the grandson of Charles I, should be the reigning king. But because Mary had a more immediate claim to the throne, her daddy was the king, William's granddaddy was the king, because Mary had a more immediate claim on the throne, there was a strong movement in England to place Mary on the throne and to make her, and not her husband William, as the reigning monarch. But the whole movement to make her queen fell apart when Mary indignantly refused to put herself forward or any claims of her own before those of her husband to whom, before God, she had submitted. Mary's sister Anne, who later became Queen of England, also agreed to waive her rights to the throne. Many people in the House of Lords clung to the ancient principle of hereditary right. They still wanted Mary because she had a more immediate claim. But the House of Commons clung to the principle of the people's power of election. And things came in a deadlock. There was a powerful movement in the Lords. We got to have Mary because she has a more immediate claim, and heredity's everything. The House of Commons said, no, heredity's important, but election and the right of people to elect their monarchs is more important. So things were at a deadlock. So William of Orange called together. He could do anything he wanted now for all practical purposes. He's invaded with his army. The king has fled. He's whipped him in Ireland, and here he is. They've asked him to come. So William of Orange calls several leaders together and tells them what's on his mind. He says, concerning himself, in his words, quote, I'm just a plain man who does not like whipped cream. He said, nor will I hold the throne by an apron string. And then he told them that the English, in his words, quote, had the absolute right to elect their king. If he were not chosen, he would return to Holland, where his own country needed him. He said, I want to be elected. If the people don't elect me, I'll not stay. So the people's representatives in Parliament elected William and Mary king and queen. Now, what's amazing about this is that Charles I, Charles II, James II burned every book they could find written by a man named Samuel Rutherford, a Scottish Presbyterian who was the Westminster Assembly. And they burned every copy they could of a book called Lex Rex that he wrote. Lex Rex means the law is king. Kings and common men are under the law. What was the Stuart's policy? Rex Lex. The king is law. He's above the law. Well, the kings burned all of these books they could find. They even declared Samuel Rutherford a capital criminal. And I think I told you, they sent a troop of soldiers to him to take him to trial, where if he was found guilty of his crimes of spreading division and heresy, he would be executed. And when the soldiers came to read the petition to him, charging him with criminal acts, they found him on his deathbed. And his response to their summoning him to the court to be tried for capital offenses, he said, please give His Majesty my regrets. I am being summoned to a greater court than his own, to which court few kings are ever summoned. Don't you love the boldness and forthrightness of these old Scottish Presbyterians? So Samuel Rutherford wrote this book, middle 1600s, long before Cromwell. Lex Rex, the law is king. And one of the reasons they had it burned was because he was a theonomist. Because he went through the Old Testament and said, here's how these various laws apply to England today. And one law is the kings have to be elected. By the way, the kings of Israel were all elected unless they were imposed upon Israel by a foreign power. And so he takes this principle of the right of the people to elect those who rule over them. He spells it out in his book. By the way, Lex Rex was one of the best-selling books in America just prior to 1776. And so because of that principle, they had the books burned. And now you have William and Mary saying, we're not going to take the throne unless the English people elect their kings through their representatives in Parliament. And so once again, these old covenanters won the day. So they elected William and Mary, and they proclaimed them King William III and Queen Mary II. And they were to jointly reign, though the administration of England was largely to rest with the king. Mary reigned for 5 years. During which time she was profoundly troubled, uneasy, unhappy. She didn't like her position as Queen of England. She was wretchedly homesick for the peace and beauty of Holland. She was tormented by the constant absences of her husband, who had to rule two countries, and for the turmoil that his administration was always in. She felt very keenly the hostility that people had toward her because of her occupation of her father's throne. And she was painfully sensitive to the treachery and the intrigue that surrounded her and her husband. These troubles and ill health reduced her to such a morbid condition that she prepared herself to die. When at the head of the affairs of state, whenever she was put in a position because of her husband's absence to rule directly herself, she always showed good sense and courage, and her brief 5-year rule was not marred by any ill behavior or ugly, sinful act. She died at the age of 32, December the 28th, 1694. William's behavior at his wife's death shows that he had a passionate affection for her. Mary's blameless life and orthodox piety made her almost a saint among the Protestants. But her father refused to permit the mourning of her death. Next week, the Lord willing, we'll talk about how the character of the monarchy and of England was changed ever since by the glorious revolution. Let us pray. Father, we do thank you for the life and the memory and the work and the contribution of William and Mary. For Jesus' sake, amen.